I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. So you wanna be a rider? Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed in the Red Room. We let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Red Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, everybody?
Wakanda. Wakanda. You got to throw up the W's.
Oh, I can't forget.
What?
Rather be throwing up Black Panther.
I'm just like that. Hey, that's Black power. Shit. Like
Wu-Tang is now being taken away from Wakanda.
Whatever gang sign you in, bitch. Throw it up. Damn it, throw it up. So, y'all know how we're doing on the Rant Room. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture. But our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. So y'all hear the Wu-Tang Clan over here.
Mm-hmm.
Little misinterruption.
I
apologize. The Black Nerdists. The original L Boogie.
The original L Boogie.
Lisa Cole.
The first
jam.
And only Lisa. Before that other Lisa came through
right. And
messed it up. Speaking of which, shout out to Lisa, because, okay, here's a short little story.
What happened? You can put it on the floor.
So, y'all, those of you who know me know I used to dance on American Bandstand back right. In the day. So when Lisa and Colt Jam first came on American Bandstand, if you go look at the tapes, I'm standing behind them. I got my white blazer. I got my bandana.
Fitted,
I got the
y'all.
Boots.
She
I was behind.
Fitted.
And she had those two, Colt Jam was her two dancers.
Right.
She was dancing, and they did these backflips, and Lisa stepped back and stepped on my foot.
Really?
So if you look at the tapes, and if you go real close up on my eyes, you will actually see water in my eyes, because that shit hurt. And we was taping live, and Dick Clark was looking at me like, you better keep it moving, bitch.
You almost
moving.
You almost pushed her in the back, didn't you?
It hurts so bad. Oh, my God. Those were the days. But, hey, can I make a confession real quick before we introduce our guest,
yes.
Who I'm excited to have?
I'm so excited to have you on here.
Oh. Oh, thank you.
But listen,
mm-hmm.
So last episode, y'all heard me tell you about the new posters that came out, right, for the Black Panther movie?
Right, right.
I may have to switch teams.
Well, what?
I want to apologize to King T'Challa, but Eric Killmonger
okay. Is
looking real nice.
Right.
And as you always know, the bad guy, the villain, always has their own hero narrative arc.
Right.
Okay? So every villain could be a hero in his own story. But I'm really feeling like I might be Team Killmonger.
Who you mean, Michael B. Jordan?
Yes.
With that bad hair he got, uh-huh.
Bad hair?
It's horrible.
Y'all,
awful.
Talisha.
Yes.
Okay, right. you've seen.
Do you agree? Is it just me?
You've seen the trailer.
I have seen the trailer.
What do you think about his hair?
He can't be bald?
I think it's blackness come alive.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I'll give it that.
Yeah. Yes.
I'll give it that.
For certain.
Yeah.
What do you not like about his hair?
It just looks
like a wig to me.
Yeah, it just doesn't look real.
It looks kind of like the hair that Idris Elba has on that gorilla show where it's like, that's not real. That's not real.
No, it does not look as bad as Luke Cage.
Oh.
Prison hair.
Right.
Where
where's your CG budget?
Afro,
I need a CG budget to do Afro.
I need to go talk to the hairstylist.
CG budget.
And talk to them about doing some really good black hair, historical black hair. So you're not gonna talk
all
about
all they need to do is contact
Michael B.
Jordan's
Pixar. Hair.
Pixar got the hair down. Pixar got
your hair.
Hold on.
It's a hot mess. Watch your mouth.
Chris and I were watching the UFC fights the other day, right? So why were we talking about, Stranger Things?
Mm.
We were like,
the little boy.
What?
Listen.
It must be a set full of white folks.
Ain't no black people doing hair.
And I'm like, don't his mom come
dear,
to the set?
Dear black
she
people.
She don't put no lipstick
dear,
on his
listen,
lips.
Listen. Dear black people.
Ain't got
when
no
you get
oil
hired,
in his
listen,
hair.
Listen.
It might be his manager only.
When you get hired on the show.
His manager might not be black.
You can hire me and Lauren. Lauren. Hey, shout out to Lauren in Toronto. You can hire me and Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
We will come and be your black set coordinator for blackness.
That should be that shit.
We will look at you and tell you, right. Does that hair texture look real? Are your lips cracked and ashy? Do you need lotion? Okay.
I'm going to tell you something.
You know, are your pants
something
too
really
tight?
Funny. I'm going to tell you something really, really funny.
Is your collar not popped?
So,
is there ash?
Shit not lined,
is there ash? Is your hair lined. Not lined up?
Right, right.
Is there ash on the back of your neck? Come on. Come on.
What's this director? What is this TV director? Black guy. Seeth Man.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love Seeth. Okay,
so Seeth Man, we used to share an agent about 10 years ago.
Talented director.
And he gave us Seeth short, the reason why he signed Seeth.
Yeah, wasn't it 5 Heartbeats? It was like the thing with the dudes, and they were going to go save the girlfriend. It was like a domestic abuse thing.
Yeah.
It was called Five Heartbeats?
I can't remember what it's called, but that's what it was.
5 Breaths, I think.
But five deep breaths. I think 5 Deep Breaths. Maybe that's what it's called. But in the credits sequence, there is a credit on it that says Minister of Culture in the credits.
You may hire me.
Because that is, you know, like Professor Griff.
Yes.
Right.
I was like, because he needed someone.
Look, I will be your female.
Like a hype man or some shit.
I'm just saying, you know what? Cut your hair right. Get the line. Do all that kind of stuff so when you're on camera.
I will come dressed as the S1Ws from Public Enemy, the security of the first world of blackness.
You just need somebody to say,
I will wear the military fatigues and come right up and let you know, do your black people look like real black people that would be, you know, that can walk around and have some pride walking around. Because some of these black stuff, I'd be looking at like, man, y'all didn't have not one black person on the crew said nothing.
It's interesting to say that about Stranger Things, because the thing about Stranger Things, again, think about it, this is in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's like he's not even wearing any kind of, like, black kids. He's not even wearing the kind of clothing that black kids wore in the suburbs. You know, like, he didn't have any kind of, like, Michael Jackson type of jacket on.
You're talking about Stranger Things?
Yeah, like nothing.
That is true.
It's like a bad kind of, like,
They're very plain. They're all of them.
They didn't know. And I'm telling you, from growing up in the suburbs, black kids wore the stuff that everyone was wearing in the streets, because that's what, because you saw it on MTV.
You need to have some bandanas,
you know,
either on your neck or on your jeans.
You know, like a Coca-Cola.
Yes.
You need to have a Coca-Cola like sweatshirt.
Where's your members only jacket?
I mean, to me. Because that's
Where's your pleather Michael Jackson wrist? Yes.
What I want to know is, bitch, where is Jerry Curl at?
That's all I'm not saying. I'm saying.
He should at least have a wave or some shit.
And where is Stranger Things?
Is there some TCB in there or something?
Is it on the East Coast or West Coast? Where is it supposed to be taking a look? Because if it's West Coast, it's going to be a California curl.
It's Midwest.
It feels like it's Midwest. Yeah. It feels like it needs to be
not a Jerry Curl, a California curl.
Something, bitch.
Willie Morrow, San Diego, California.
It should be shiny. That's all I'm saying.
And a little drippy. He should have, like, when we go in his room, when we look at the pillowcase, there need to be like a line of grease.
It's not coming to America bad. It's not coming to America bad.
You want
to
make it real?
I'm just saying it's not that bad. No.
You want to make it real?
No, I don't want to make it real.
Let's get into the show.
There are some things called a little too real.
Television movies are supposed to be metaphors of reality.
Y'all doing extra right now. So...
I apologize.
If you guys
Alicia,
are grown,
quite all right.
If you guys are grown, let's go ahead and get it in. So, welcome to the show, everybody. Talisha Rags, everybody.
Hello.
Writer, producer herself.
Mm-hmm. I am.
Little Miss Braid Dreadlock herself.
I got you. I got my Senegalese twist going on.
Oh, she got the
right
Senegalese
here.
On today.
Yes, it's very
and
specific.
And it's shiny, too. She
and
took
shiny.
Care of her shit.
That's right.
Yes.
I got the spray and everything.
Yes,
okay. See, it's those little details like that.
Mm-hmm.
That when you have black people, you gotta have that little detail. You do.
So welcome to the show, Mama.
Why, thank you.
So tell the kids a little bit about who you are, how you got into the game, how you got to this point.
I was gonna say, which version do you want?
I want the real.
You want the real version? Because we'll be here all night.
I want the real.
But I will give you the abbreviated 1 hour version.
Okay, let's get it.
So I am originally from Gary, Indiana.
Okay.
Michael Jackson?
Uh-huh. Yes,
they cousins.
Which, you know, it's so funny because whenever, you know, the race of the people is straight down the middle. Whenever I tell white people, it's always the Music Man.
Right.
Gary, Indiana. Indiana, Gary, Indiana. Whenever I tell black people, it's always like, the Jacksons. Correct. Oh, Michael and Jackson, the Jacksons. Mm-hmm.
She's one of their cousins.
Which, uh-huh. with she the related. Exception of some diehard white Michael Jackson fans who have broken the mold, mm-hmm. you know, because nothing is ever 100%. Right. But I have never, from a black person, ever gotten the Music Man. That's always...
What's his name again? Preston? Who played the Music Man? Wasn't it? His name is Preston. First name is Preston.
From the brother show?
In the movie.
Oh, I never saw it, to tell you the truth.
I never watched either. I'm not a musical person. I apologize. The only musicals I watched was
Danny
Kaye.
I should know better, too. Like,
You should know better.
I love musicals, but that was just a little too far back for me.
You know what? He was later in... I tried to interrupt, but he was later in... Victor Victoria. Preston. His first name, last name is Preston. Anyway.
It'll come. Anyway.
Okay.
No. Well. Okay. So go ahead, Mom. Happen to have the knower of all things devices.
I'm pulling the bitch up now. Look, go on ahead.
But So I grew up in Gary, Indiana. My dad was a radio jock, so he worked in Chicago. My dad's family.
What was his DJ name?
His DJ name was the Ragman. So that was his moniker. He still goes by it to this day. Because he is still on the radio. Nice. He does his Dusty Dance parties, I think, Saturday night.
A Dusty Dance party? What's he playing? What is he playing?
Well, you know, like old school soul funk.
With the light broken in the basement. Two fingers on the waist. Chris. Not quite Quiet Robert Storm, Preston. But like classic. Preston, oh, man. That's
well, not quite Quiet Storm, because, you know, it's supposed to get you up and dancing. Mm-hmm. Right. But he also does blues shows. Depending on the time period, or the time slot that they have him in that week. Okay. So it really sort of depends on that. But he is on 106.3 Soul in Chicago. Shout out to my dad.
Hold on.
You got to do the voice. You got to do the voice.
I just got an image of that. You're like, 106.3 Soul.
Right, man.
She was just a little kid with her feet just rocking left.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'd be in the studio, you know, with my, you know, playing with the track. You know, carts. They call them carts, right. You know. I think they still have them, or is everything digital now? They do still have some carts, because everybody... has a little leeway to do what they want on their shows, but oh yeah, oh my God! Sometimes I would be in the studio, and he would have me, my sister, and brother answering the hotline.
Okay,
you
really?
Know, and getting the names of the people.
So 106 hotline.
Put the dedications and stuff on the air. Back when I was a little girl. Oh, he's worked at a lot of stations though. Mm-hmm. So I mean, yeah. So over the years, you know, he's worked on quite a few of them, and it's always entertaining to listen to him because I mean, he does his whole Jim Rags, Ragman, 106 Soul. Yeah. I mean, you know, his whole Wolfman Jack kind of thing is always fun
Wolfman
and funny.
Yeah. Go way back.
Yeah. So I grew up there. I went to a visual and performing arts school as a drama major. Mm-hmm. I never really thought that I was going to. I always loved movies and music and, you know, and TV, and always wanted to sort of write my own thing. But I never really
thought. Did you do a lot of theater then?
We did theater at Emerson. I mean, we would always have like two major shows a year. Mm-hmm. And I never really gave any thought to actually coming out and doing something like this, because at the time there was only one person who was doing anything in the world. Her name was Oprah, and I didn't look like her. So so I never really, you know, gave any thought to anything. I mean, besides sort of the Cosby Show, that was the one thing.
Right.
This
is before the 90s for y'all young motherfuckers, by the way.
Yeah, for the youngins in the world. Okay. I was going on the engineering route. So I had applied to the Air Force and Naval Academy and
gotten
in.
She's smart. Look at this bitch.
And my senior year of high school, I did a bridging year program at a place called Clarkson University. It's called the Clarkson School, where you do your senior year of high school and your freshman year of college at the same time. Okay. And it was an engineering school. I was just trying to get away from home. I was just like, I want to be free. Right. So if you're going to send your child someplace to be free, you can send them to Potsdam, because there's nothing happening there. I mean, absolutely nothing.
Damn.
You can pluck them there.
Is it rural there?
It is very rural. Okay. And the only thing that's there are schools, which is Clarkson University and then SUNY Potsdam. And then everything around it is nothing but trees and corn.
Okay.
So you can rest assured that if you send your child to the Clarkson School or anything, into either school in Potsdam, they will come back, you know, a fully functioning human being without any addictions or any personality.
So they ain't got no meth there,
to tell you the damn. Truth, because I mean, there is absolutely nothing to do there.
But that's when people get into dangerous shit. They gotta start making shit up.
You just end up doing homework. I mean, all the time. It's like, oh, what's fun to do? Oh, well, homework. I guess I could do that. That's something interesting.
All right.
So I did that. And one of the classes that I was in was a writing class. And I would write the stuff, and the teacher would encourage me. It's like, you know, you should really think about doing this stuff for a living. So I was like, no, I'm going to the academies. You know, my favorite word in the English language, aka my favorite four-letter word, is free. So, I look at trying to get things as close to free as possible. So right. When it came to my college education, I was looking at free. You know, the Air Force and Naval Academy are both free. So it was, that's where I'm going, because it's free. But he encouraged me to do that, and I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll apply to the best film school in the country, which at the time was USC. Mm-hmm. USC and NYU are still, number one, number two. They battle back and forth, respectively. Mm-hmm. I'll apply to the number one film school in the country. If it's my destiny, I'll get in. Right. If not, I'll go to the academies, and I'll be happy because I won't have a, student loan saddle on my back or whatever.
Right. Saddle.
And,
bricks.
Saddle, okay. Bricks, click, horse. Click. I mean, and I got in.
Okay.
And then I changed my plans and ended up going to USC Film School for 4 years. I got out.
Did you go there for writing? Did you end up doing the whole...
I was an undergrad, so I went there for production.
Okay.
Because at the time, the only thing they had was production, but they did have a BFA program in screenwriting. But at the time, I will admit that I was kind of lazy, and even though I would sort of write things on my own, I wanted to be a producer because, I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll read people's writing because I always gave great notes, and I'll give them notes, and I'll produce the stuff. So then that way I can be involved in writing, but then I don't actually have to write because,
What? This is a woman with a plan.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
But, because writing is very, when you're doing it right, it is extremely hard because in order to do anything that is good, if it's going to be just good at all, you have to put yourself in the writing. Right. And if you're putting yourself in the writing, it's painful.
Yes.
Y'all hear that? Why do I want to subject myself to pain if I don't have to? Right. I know what I'll do. I'll latch on to somebody else's pain and ride that train to fame and fortune.
Right.
But the urge had always been in me, and the burning desire had always been there. And I was sort of turning away from it because it was scary. And it was hard to do because it was scary to access those emotions. Mm. But at some point it was like, are you going to do what you know you need to do, or are you just going to sort of fake it, being out here? So, there was a point where I was just like, you know what? I got to start writing because I know that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And when I got out of film school, I proceeded to do a whole lot of nothing because I could not get a job to save my life. Right. And I kept trying to get on the path to become a producer. Mm. I kept trying to become producer's assistant. I kept trying to become creative executive. Mm-hmm. I kept trying to become a development executive. I kept trying.
Were you focused on TV still then, or were you?
And they weren't letting people do that.
It was either or. It was, everything back then was film. This was before. Pre-golden age of TV.
Right.
So everything was film. And it's funny how there's destiny and then there's free will. And I believe sort of in a combination of both.
I believe that
we are destined to do certain things, but we have the free will to choose it or not.
Okay.
And if we don't choose it, we'll just continue to go back in a circle and hit our head on a brick wall, and then that opportunity will come up again.
Right.
Are you going to choose it this time?
Right.
No? Okay, well, then you're going to go back in a circle, and you have the free will to choose it, and you're not doing it, and you're not doing what you're supposed to do, and then that opportunity will come up again. Will you choose it this time? Yes! And then you choose it, and then you go on your destined path.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring that up, because a lot of times I think... You made an interesting point. People are afraid people are afraid to write for a lot of reasons. Particularly if you read a lot. See, I think honestly, if you read a lot, then you recognize really strong writing,
right.
And then it takes a minute for you to even like then be able to kind of like reverse engineer why the writing is good.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you figure that out, you're like, oh, I don't want to do that shit. That's hard.
yeah.
That's hard.
Hey, mind your business.
Exactly.
Mind your business. Stop telling people's business out there.
But you make a good point about, you know, I think in that time when you're like, if you're on that treadmill, that circular treadmill coming around, you know, how many times are you going to let it come around where you can say, I'm going to jump on this now.
Right.
And then, you know, it becomes now it's this place where it's like this circle takes you to this circle and then to this circle and then this circle, you know, so you just keep moving up and staying on the circles. That's an interesting point.
Thing about the circles is sometimes those circles take years to circle back
they
around
do.
Them.
Mm-hmm. You know yes, I mean?
Years.
They do.
How about
and
decades?
No, but I'm just
how about decades?
I had to learn.
Decades.
Right. I had to learn the hard way because it was a little over 10 years before I got my big break.
Okay, wait. Say that again.
A little over 10 years to become an overnight sensation. And it wasn't even an overnight sensation. it was a break, and then there was another break. Okay. It was a break, and then after that show ended, there was another, you know, long right. period of time till the next break right. came. But the point is that I had the path that I knew I wanted to be on, and then I had the path that I knew that I should be on. Okay. And they were not in, you know,
in
conjunction
sync.
In sync
right.
with each other.
Right.
Because I will completely admit, you know, I was hard-headed. Now, some of it is, you know, there are factors in this industry that keep certain people out of certain things.
No, there are not.
You know, I hate to break it to you. There's one or two things that, you know. And was I a victim of that? I hate to say that because I've been in... I mean, sure, you can say that. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I've been in situations with executives that I've known and I've seen how they hire people.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me, I was like, I get it. I can't exactly call it racism, but I see what they're doing now. People in executives, people in power positions who make it to a position and then it's time to hire an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I see what they're doing. They're hiring people who remind them of them.
You hear that, kid?
You know, they're hiring people that remind them of them
right.
because they're like, oh, when I was coming up, you know, I did this and I did that, and they remind me of me, and I want to give them that shot that I never had.
Well, see, look, that's a line you hear all the time from the people. Like, I remember when Colin Trevorrow was, mm-hmm. like, getting his pub after Jurassic World,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there was this whole statement in Wired about the thing where Brad Bird was like, he reminds me of me. He reminds
yeah.
me of me,
right.
so let me just bring him in and,
right.
you know, and then the rest is what it is. And
right.
And that, yeah, I don't know if that's racism. That's just...
But it
not
but
looking
explains,
outside the box,
you know, because
yeah.
these same
yeah.
these
not,
same
not
people,
seeing yourself and
you
other
can,
folks that don't
right.
have to look like you.
Exactly, because and you're exactly right,
mm-hmm.
because all of these white movies, you mm-hmm. know, and TV shows that would come out and black people would watch, you know, we could see ourselves in those characters.
Right.
But then when you say, okay, well, how about, you know, in, you know, a few years ago, not even that long ago, you say, okay, well, how about we have some black movies with black heroes
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and black villains and other, or people of other colors, you know, Latinos or Asians. And then the argument from the other side was, oh, nobody will go see it. Well, in their mind, why will no one go see it? Oh, well, because they would never see themselves in those type of people. And that is
been doing it
completely untrue.
Since film and literature has existed, we have always done that.
They can relate to hip hop,
okay.
but they can't relate to a movie.
Well,
right,
no,
right.
no. But see, I mean, look, the rationale behind that is, and it has to go to the white supremacy thing. I'm on the top. Why would I like see myself in a position of, you know, that's lesser?
Mm-hmm.
That's so, you know,
that's
what
real.
I can't. I mean, like that in itself, and, you know, this is something that we might not have been thinking a lot, but Age of Trump, we have to say this now because that I think totally this is what it is they can't see themselves in a position of being in a lesser position. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's like, it's not lesser if you look at everybody as human.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Thank but you. Right. And now, not only that, and not only that, human. It's not lesser if you look at the numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're talking the 90s and 80s. I mean, it even sort of blaxploitation films when they right. came out in the 70s. You know, it wasn't just black people going to see those.
Oh, trust. At the drive-in, everybody.
Made money. Right, you know,
Quentin Tarantino proved that white people loved black movies.
Yes.
Right.
Loved exactly. black movies.
Exactly. And in the 90s, I mean, look at freaking Eddie Murphy. I mean, Coming to America, black people weren't the only ones that were going to see that. Right. It was just the executives, the very old school executives who were the people who had the power to green light mm-hmm. at the time, that was their thinking. Right. Because then, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s.
Well, I feel like I'm in church. I'm like, well.
Mm-hmm. You know, you had to show. And then as those people get moved out, as the new guard comes and moves in, and they're saying, oh, well, those old school type of movies aren't selling anymore. We have to find the next green product. We have to find the next batch of films to mine that will make us a profit. Because at the end of the day, it's all about green. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, there was a whole period where just nothing was happening with minorities and movies or anything at all, I was like, that can't stand. Because there will come a time, I mean, look at freaking Oprah. There will come a time when all the stories that can be written by, you know, straight white men will have been written and will have been rewritten and rewritten using the same,
come on now,
you know, things all from right. that right. culture.
All these remakes.
Is new.
Take my
listen,
shoe.
Nothing is new. Listen, collection plays. Boring, you know, and it's boring, and there's nothing that's surprising about that because you've seen it so many times that, you know, I won't say it's boring. I mean, they're often very good movies and very good TV shows. However,
but their time has passed.
I won't say their time is past, but I will say our time is now. And I don't mean just, you know, black. I mean Latino. Well, right. I mean also Asian. Yeah, right. Because they are just
This you a really interesting point. Just reminded me of something that I think that is. There's always something really fucked up when people. There's an accusation of, say, doing stunt casting, mm-hmm. where you're casting someone that might have been written as a white role, mm-hmm. and you're casting somebody black. I do not think enough people know that Beverly Hills Cop
was written for a white guy. It was written for
Stallone. It was set to star Stallone, and it only worked out the way it did because Al Pacino wanted to do Scarface.
And it wouldn't have been the same movie with Stallone. I don't think the movie would have been as popular with Sylvester Stallone because if you think about that movie, the reason that movie works is because Eddie Murphy is a total opposite.
Right.
You know, you see Stallone and you see him as, you know, the tough, strong guy from Rambo and mm-hmm. from Rocky, you know, but it's not too big of a leap to think that he could fit in with a Beverly Hills cop and then solve Beverly Hills crime. Cops from Beverly Hills might not necessarily believe
especially
him.
Especially a cop from Detroit.
He doesn't have to speak, you know, look, he doesn't have to open his mouth and he could walk into Victor Maitland's office. Right. But Axel Foley is a black guy walks into Victor Maitland's office.
Yeah, I like to speak to Victor
and
Maitland.
And they throw him out the damn, they throw him out the damn window.
Right.
Because like, because they're like, banana. Negro, you're not supposed to be up in here.
Right.
So roll.
Exactly.
Look. I mean, like, I think that, I mean, that's just a classic example of like, I brought that up because you had said people don't see themselves in other people.
Mm-hmm.
But it took, I forget the director's name who did that, but Martin Brest, he had the vision to say, I can see Axel Foley as a black guy, mm-hmm. and I think it'll be even cooler.
Especially that name, Axel.
Make it work.
Right.
You
know? Right.
Well, think about it.
Absolutely.
Who else do we know his name is Axel? Axel Rose is the only other person we know. True.
Yeah, but then also, you know, you had Trading Places. I mean, mm-hmm. and Trading Places was a huge hit, mm-hmm. you know, for Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
You know, before then, they needed another Eddie Murphy project. And it's like, you know, well, why not? And And that movie works. It's a good script and it's a good movie. But one of the reasons that, it is so fantastic is because Eddie Murphy,
he brings
it something that's so very opposite, so very unexpected to what you would try to pair with a Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, you're just like, this is never going to work.
Taggart and Rosewood don't work. Exactly.
The journey for Axel Foley to become believable, for these guys to take Axel Foley, seriously, the journey for that is much more satisfying because he's so far from anything that you would expect to be a Beverly Hills Cop. And the things that he, and then not only that, but then these guys are so... The reason that the drugs were going through, Beverly Hills, is because these Beverly Hills cops knew nothing about what street people were doing. Right. And so they were able to get stuff by these people because... they had no idea how
the coffee in the Arctic. Exactly. That's y'all don't know about that shit.
Or the fingerprints and the super glue, sort of thing. Which police departments have been using before. But the whole premise being that these Beverly Hills cops, they never have to solve any major crime. So they never have to really, look at any of these techniques in solving crime. Whereas the Detroit cop, he does. Right. And he's in Detroit and he's a brother and he's a guy that, you gets easily kicked out of Beverly Hills location.
I can't even see Stallone hanging on that.
It would be a completely different movie.
Like that scene in the beginning,
it would have been a drama, first of all.
Yeah. He's in the damn the cigarette truck in the beginning. Right. I can't see Stallone hanging out of that thing when it's moving around. I just can't see that. But that's why that movie works the way it is. But you're right. I borrow that up because it's like your whole statement about these executives weren't seeing you, and you were seeing how they're not good. They, you have to make the leap. It's, to me, something that bothers me so much about this industry is so many people who are those executives in power, so many of them, not all of them, a lot of them just don't have the imagination to see farther than what is right there on the page.
Well, but also too, in Hollywood, you keep your job by saying no.
Right.
You keep your job by saying no. You know, to go out on a limb for something and then be wrong, it's kind of how you lose your job. So if I'm an executive who's just trying to move up in the world, I don't want to screw up. I'm just gonna do enough just to keep my job. Right. And if I, say no and I'm gonna pass on this because it has this kind of person in it, I'm gonna pass on this because it has this kind of person in it, But what has happened is, first of all, the movie business has changed. But before the movie business has changed and we started getting more movies and more indies with not just Black but Latino, Real Women Have Curves. Something like that, where you're looking, every story is relatable. There's seven stories, right? But the reason that Real Women Have Curves succeeded and was so fantastic is because it was a movie about universal themes, everything everyone else goes through, but it came out of a different culture, something that we had never seen before.
Yeah. What's that, and like America Ferrara in that?
We'd never seen before.
I think Effie Brown was producing that. Shout out to Effie Brown.
Exactly. It's like the type of grandmothers. We all had those grandmothers, but to see those grandmothers saying these sayings, which were hysterical, comes out of this culture, and as a white man, you're not going to get that because you don't know that. You didn't grow up in that. Right. And maybe you can interview Latinos or whatever and maybe get a sense of their culture. I'm not saying that someone who does not live in a culture or whatever cannot write a good, authentic project. That's not true. However, it's probably easier to find someone in that particular culture to write something good faster than anyone else outside of that culture, because the person that's in it knows what to mine, And they know which questions to ask, and they know, you know, and then they sort of know how to sort of pattern the story, as opposed to the other person who really does need to do a lot of research, right, and then sort of absorb it in order to say, okay, how am I going to translate this into a script and have it be authentic? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, it's not saying it can't happen, because of course it can, but, you know, but it will probably take a lot longer, yeah, and, you know, and why not use the people who are already there and already, you know, and who can already
you say
know
that,
the stories.
Can you say that one more again? Say that one more again. Use the people that are already there.
Well, you know, or it's, you know, it's the thing about do... Also, it's like, what do you feel, you know, if it's not your culture, do you know how far to go?
Like, true, a
very,
exactly.
It's a very interesting...
Especially in comedy. Yeah, well, do you know how far to go? You know, do you know how to, you know, draw it back? I mean, because African-American culture, I mean, we happen to be a little bigger with our expressions.
Right.
You know...
A little louder.
And we're a little louder, and we laugh
a little louder.
Just a little louder. Just a little. You know?
I would say exponentially, but...
Oftentimes, you know, we are, you know, we're put down because of that. But it's like, you know what?
Oh, yeah.
Why be
you
put
can't
down
laugh like that, like, at the job.
Look, this is, you know, this is our culture. This is what we came from. Why is it wrong? Right. But it's wrong to certain people because it doesn't fit in their sort of, you know, it doesn't fit in their sort of box. And so it just sort of gets deemed as, oh, loud and unattractive or whatnot. Yeah. You know, so then someone coming from that area to write something for us or, you know, film us or whatever, won't exactly know to say, okay, oh, no, you know what? That's too big, or that's not big enough, or, you know, how am I going to keep this funny without being, you know, without moving over into a stereotypical right. type yeah. of coon right. situation. Right. You know, so
well, yeah, because the coon situation is what white people are more accustomed to seeing black people behave in.
Right.
And then black people are like, you know what, that's like 10% too much. So if you just ran yeah. it back, then it wouldn't be. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it's like there was a, you know, I was watching the Spielberg documentary, mm-hmm. you know, which is really, really
so good.
Really, really good. Mm-hmm. But it's a really great point mm-hmm. when Kathleen Kennedy is talking about when he did Color Purple. Mm-hmm. And she's like, he just wouldn't go as far as what was in the book. It just wasn't in there for him mm-hmm. to get what was in there. You know, mm-hmm. she just was like, you know, when we really, you know, like her and Quincy, like kind of wanted it to be more, it just wasn't him. And that's what I mean. It's like you don't really know how far to go. Maybe it's right. like, maybe it's not in you to want to go that far
right.
because it's too foreign for you to feel comfortable with.
Well, I thought I read or heard somewhere in the last 10 years, he actually said it's the one movie he almost thinks somebody black should have directed.
Yeah.
You think?
I thought I heard or read it somewhere. Is
what,
that true?
That someone black should have directed?
Like that, like oh of all God. The movies he done, like that's the one movie he feels like somebody, I thought I read
I don't, it. Well, know you know that. What? I remember maybe. At the time, because I think I was maybe 9 or 10, and I remember the controversy mm-hmm. with it. Mm-hmm. With saying, why is Spielberg directing this movie? Right. He's making it too pretty, and this, and this, and that, and that, and this. And this and that and that. Ooh. But as a kid who then saw the movie, right. I was like, I don't know. I mean, now granted, I was a child and my, you know, my point of view was, you know, a little different. I didn't go through the experiences of my mother and my father right. who grew up in civil rights, mm-hmm. you know. But as a kid who was watching that and as a kid who read the book, I'm, you know, I'm watching it. I'm in tears mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm completely enjoying the movie. And even today, to this day, I can watch that movie and say, you know, that is it's a great movie. It's a great movie.
It's one of my
period.
Top five, personally.
It's, you know, hands down. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I just want to sort of. But yeah. And so I think that probably some of that was because of the pushback that he got during that day, because they wanted someone like a Gordon Parks right. or something, you know, someone who was African-American yeah. to direct that. And true, Gordon Parks would have probably made a wonderful movie. But Steven Spielberg, having his name on the movie,
you gotta be real
was
about that.
Was the reason that movie got made.
That's all I was gonna say.
Okay, it got yeah. made because his name was yep. on the mm-hmm. movie, and it got seen by people
yep.
because his name was on the movie. This is the biggest director in the world
especially at that time.
Especially at that time,
right.
Where who had a spotlight on him, right. And he was like, "I want to put a spotlight on this story."
Right.
And where, you know, and like I said, Gordon Parks could have made a beautiful movie, but then it would have been Sankofa. You know, I mean, not necessarily Sankofa the movie, but I mean, but in terms of the number of people, I don't necessarily mean, you know, I mean Sankofa and Halle Germany. He's a wonderful filmmaker. Yes. That's a fantastic movie.
Yes.
But I'm talking about in terms of who saw it,
right,
and who had careers because
started
of it,
because
and
of
who
that.
Started careers,
and that's real.
Off of that.
That's real.
You know,
this is the thing. That movie, Quincy, because I heard Quincy talking about this maybe 15 years ago. He was kind of like, the movie wouldn't have been made. Spielberg was coming off of E.T., and it was like, that movie, I remember it came out, and my mom was like, "You gotta see this movie," because she read the book, and I was like, I think 10 or something like that. And I was like, and it's a heartbreaking movie.
Mm-hmm. Very much
so.
You
know, and, you know, and then later I read the book, and I was like, he has the essence of the book in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, there's certain things that are different, but right. I'm kind of like, again, you can't do a book. You have to make those choices.
Yes, absolutely.
And I feel like what he did is like that movie compared to a whole lot of films at that time that came out that might have come out don't stand up the same way,
right?
You know, and
exactly.
I mean, it's just interesting. It's interesting to see who would have done it. I mean, is Oprah around? Is Whoopi around? Maybe they are. I mean, it's
Danny Glover.
It's just before Lethal Weapon.
Fishburne.
Right.
I mean, these people. You know, like you think about it. The cast is all different. Mm-hmm. Like everything is different about that movie if she doesn't do it.
But then also, too, with the type of movies that were coming out back then, you know, he got the essence of the book, but there are just some things that you're not going to be able to dive into. This was the freaking 80s. Right. You're not going to, and at the time, you know, you're not going to dive into
the clear story,
you know, relationship.
Right.
But he glanced, he pushed, he glanced, we have butterflies,
okay.
right, pushed it as far, he could go. Right. And I guarantee you that the studio was probably like, can we take that out?
And
the only reason that it's probably in is because the name, you know, Spielberg.
Right.
And I was very fortunate that, my very first show that I got my big break on was a comedy starring his stepdaughter.
How did that come to you? What happened?
I ended at college and right. then all of a sudden we
this,
got
this is why we called
you was hustling and then the big break
you can come back around
this, this no, is why me, you,
this, this
you
is why we're called the rant room
because okay, okay,
we
okay.
go off on rants
okay yeah yeah, yeah. So wait, I gotta get back to, you know, so it basically was 10 years. But let me tell the Spielberg story and then I'll go back to saying how I got that gig. But anyway, it was his stepdaughter, Jessica Capshaw. It was a comedy written by Paula Pell. It was called Thick and Thin. It was on NBC. It was supposed to be on NBC. It never made it to air. The 13 episode order got cut to 6 episodes and the show never made it to air, like I said. However, you know, it was a multicam that was shot at Universal and Amblin happens to be at Universal.
Okay.
So he and his wife would come and support Jessica by just sort of hanging out on stage, and I was just like, "Oh my God, there's Steven Spielberg! Should I talk to him? Oh my God, you know, like all the other writers during the other taping days, they would talk to him. Like, they're like, why don't you just go talk to him? Like, but I'm scared. I'm a staff writer, you know. He could end my career in one word. And I was like, no, he's great. Go talk to him. So on the last day that we were shooting, he was by himself. And I went to talk to him, and I had 15 whole minutes.
I hear he's the
speaking
nicest guy.
With Steven Spielberg and his wife, mm-hmm. Kate Capshaw, and they were lovely. I mean, they were just absolutely lovely. You know, I told, I was able to tell him about, you know, basically, I mean, he's one of the reasons that I'm in the business, you know, because when I was a kid, or I'm sure you guys probably experienced some of this, when parents should have been leaving you with a babysitter to go to the movies.
Right.
Yeah, and no, that wasn't happening. The black parents were taking their kids to the movies. Right. So
tell it.
Tons of stuff that tell we the probably truth. Shouldn't have seen.
Tell the truth, shame the devil.
Because like, if they wanted to go,
they were taking you.
We didn't have no babysitter.
You better not talk in that theater. You better not talk in that theater either. Or I'm going to slap you.
You better eat popcorn. You better eat some bologna sandwich and shut the hell up.
But then there were also drive-ins where you could drive in and then, you know, the baby, you know,
hold on. You feed what's the drive-in?
You know what?
Shut up. Y'all know the drive-in?
You put the baby in
the backseat. I was the baby in the backseat watching J.D.'s
It's not a drive-through? Is it?
Godfather.
So the first movie I remember parts of The Birds, but it had to have been re-released because The Birds came out after I was born. But I explicitly remember seeing Jaws. I was like two.
God bless you. That's some good parenting right there.
Explicitly remember seeing Jaws. I was two. I was sitting on my dad's lap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We all was on dad's lap.
I was sitting on dad's lap and I was thoroughly engrossed in the story. And I got it. I was following the story.
Mm-hmm.
And every time the music would come on, my dad would put his hands over my eyes.
Really?
And I'd be like, Daddy, stop. Stop, Daddy. I can't see. Daddy, stop. I can't see. Until the scary part was over, right? Except there's one part that's not telegraphed in the movie, and that's when, you know, spoiler alert, Ben Gardner.
Really, bitch?
40 years later.
You better tell her about now.
when Ben Gardner's head appears, you know, out, you know, the boat, he floats out of the boat. Like, so that wasn't telegraphed, and I was two, and I saw that, and it scared the bejesus out of me. I had nightmares, you know, for the next week.
I did too.
It's a great scene.
It's a great scene. Right. And I got to tell Steven Spielberg about that story, and he just cracked up. And Kate Capshaw was just like, oh, honey. She was just like, she was hugging him from the side. She's like, oh, honey. Like, that was so cute. I was like, oh, they're so cute together. I just love them. I got to talk to him about Amistad. I got to talk to him about The Color Purple.
Right.
And I specifically said, I was like, look, you know, I was a kid when The Color Purple came out, and I know you got a lot of flack for directing The Color Purple, but let me tell you, for my generation, that is the I Ching movie. Okay, it is. I mean, we all know lines to it. I mean, Uto Harpo,
who this? Who this woman?
Okay, Harpo, who this woman? Uto Harpo to beat me? Come on.
And we can do it all day long.
Exactly. I was just rolling off the lines, and he was
you
just
let him
laughing.
Do his thing on you,
and he was just laughing. He was just like, thank you. I was like, and for Amistad, I know you guys. Flag on Amistad, but also know he has an African American son, and he wanted to do something, you know, for his son, you know, that sort of showed his, I believe yes, and that showed. But I don't know if he had her at that point. I think maybe she came later. I'm not sure, but wanted to sort of do something that showed his or their heritage. And I was like, you know, thank you so much for that, because of course, you know, that's another movie that probably wouldn't have been made.
No, well, and, you know, it wouldn't have been made without him doing it. And again, it goes back to our thing about, you know, do you have the imagination to see yourself beyond your thing?
Right.
Because wasn't Debbie Allen the one who kind of pushed it? Not pushed on it, but like, developed it.
Debbie was one of the producers. Yeah, Debbie was one of the people who was definitely pushing that movie, and he did it. And I mean, and at that time, I had never seen such a graphic portrayal of the Middle Passage.
Right.
And
With the bone, the bodies over the side.
I was just crumble in the theater. I mean, when I'm watching it, I'm just like. Just crumble in tears, you know, and oh my God. And it was very painful, but then at the same time, it's like, you know what, look what we have gone through. Look what we have gone through. Look what we have overcome. Look at, you know, we have plenty of problems in our community today, but for all of the successes and everybody that has, you know, has gotten to success after, you know, being in situations where it was basically designed to kill you and not necessarily your body, because you needed to work, but certainly your spirit.
Right.
And our spirits were never killed. It was passed down to children mm-hmm. who, you know, hopeful children, you know, who continue the fight to become better people and, you know, and to make the world a better place. You know, so, I mean, it was Chris, just a phenomenal.
You breathing all into the mic? Wheezing all into the mic.
Get your headphones on. It's like,
I'm just listening. I'm captivated by your story when you're talking about what's going on.
Well, so it was a wonderful experience meeting him. And meeting his wife and absolutely and being on the show. I mean, it was a grand, just really fantastic sort of first, you know, introduction into the above the line side right. of the business. And then after that show was over, I didn't work for another year and a half.
Okay.
Me back to the dumps. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm back. You know, right. I'm scraping rent together again. Mm-hmm. But okay, so how I got there is a very unusual story. As a matter of fact, it's like I said, you know, I did not get an industry job. I was just looking for any industry job. And I could not get an industry job to save my life. I mean, I was, you know, calling people to sending my resume in to be PAs. Mm-hmm. I mean, just anything and everything. And for years, I didn't get anything. And there were interviews where I had a fantastic interview. But again, I with free will, I made the wrong choice. You know, like, for example, I mean, I do absolutely honestly believe I was destined to be in TV. But my mind, you know, had film. I'm trying to be film. I'm trying to be film. And I remember I had an interview for an assistant position with a company. And I think it was Spring Spreak.
Finance company. Yeah.
Development, production company, and finance. And, I had an interview, to be an assistant to their, film development person. Right. And this was a guy. And then they were like, you know what? Our TV development person is looking for an assistant as well. So do you mind if she sits in on an interview? I'm like, no, sure, come in. And so she came into the interview, and she and I were just popping. We were rolling. I mean, we were just like joking back and forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, the chemistry between the two of us was amazing. And then she finally asked, she's like, so let me ask you, if you had a choice, and it was amazing, the chemistry with him.
Don't tell me. Okay.
The chemistry.
Let me brace myself. Let me.
Was not the best. Right. You know, I mean, but I still had given a good interview with him. Mm-hmm. And she said, so if you have a choice to do film or TV, you know, if you had a choice to do film or TV, which would you do? I was like, well, I can't exactly make a choice because, you know, getting into the industry. She's like, no.
Yeah.
If you had a choice to do film or TV.
Listen, bitch.
What would you do?
She was like,
so she
what would you?
She, in the middle of your excuse.
She's like, right. She's like, so if
she's
you had
trying
a
to
choice,
correct you. She's trying to help
if you.
You
had a choice between to work for film or TV, which would you work for? Which would you choose? I said, well, if I had a choice between film and TV, I would choose work. She's like, no. Choose.
Damn, third time.
I'm like, well, look, I have to be honest. I mean, you know, I came in here for the film interview. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to work both sides. I came in here for the film assistant interview. However, you know, this interview with you was really great, you know, and I have to say that, you know, I'm very open to working whichever.
Still don't answer the question.
I mean, no, right. I did answer the question. I was like, I came in for the film interview. So that's what I came in for. So if I had to make a choice, I mean, that's what I came in for. However, you know, what you came in and this was very unexpected. And and if you would have me, I would be happy to be here. Right. And she's like, oh, okay, great. And so then I left and didn't get either job. Mm-hmm. So it was like, damn, I should have chose TV. You know, it's like,
lessons in that.
She's basically giving, this is something that happens in this town like quite a bit, is that.
Were we not just talking about this yesterday?
They have these kind of like passive ways of trying to see what you want to do. And the, mm-hmm. the whole fact that mm-hmm. the film guy brought in the TV woman for the interview was like, this is the job we can give you.
Right.
Are you going to take it, or are you going to, you know, because I can't, because if somebody really wants you, then I could bring in competition to, right. to the, you know, yeah. so that they would fight. Because right. if you were like, well, who wants me more? And, you know, I mean, and that's essentially what you said, you know, like to pull it all away. It's like, well, if you want me more, I'm going with you. If you want me more, I'm going with you. And she's kind of like,
you need to decide.
If you want the job, because I'm telling you, the job.
Be decisive.
The job is right here for you. I'm putting my hand out.
Hey, what? Alicia said, I'm like 26. I'm 27.
Throw me the whip or throw me the idol.
I didn't know.
What is it?
I didn't know. I didn't know. So,
but it goes back.
That's a great experience. That's
okay. Yeah. I love it. But it goes back to you saying about the circle. Because I noticed it's going to come back around, like, you know, 5-6 years later. Hey, do you want to come back and work in TV?
So yep. When was your circle? So what was your circle that came back around?
So, okay, here we go. So what ends up happening is many years of having every job under the sun, which I did every job under the sun.
How many jobs you got, man?
Everyone. Like, everyone. If you name it, I did it. At some point in my career,
I was digging dishes.
I was painting. I was a dog walker. I was a child care worker. Mm. I worked at a group home. You know, I was a snowboarding instructor.
What?
I mean, now, but that job...
At Big Bear?
Mountain High.
Okay.
I was a snowboarding instructor at Mountain High, and part of that was because, remember, I like to get things as close to free as possible. So when you're broke and you're trying to live lifestyle of the rich and famous, you know, lifestyle, mm-hmm. you got to figure out a back door to the way to get right. in the back door, because you can't exactly walk in the front because you don't have any money. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to snowboard, but I mean. Like freaking passes were just
and your lift
exactly
ticket and
like season passes and lift tickets and equipment for snowboards
boots and boots and
I mean, you're talking thousands of dollars, right. And here I am making $8 an hour, you know, working as a child care worker. Mm-hmm. I couldn't afford that, so what did I do? So I went and I took a lesson for, I think at the time it was $90. So it was a lesson and the lift ticket for $90. And I learned how to do what was in the lesson well enough so that the next year came.
I'm teaching it.
And they were looking for instructors. Mm-hmm. I applied to be an instructor. And I remember everything that and the way the guy taught me. And then I added a couple of flourishes onto it, mm-hmm. So that I could go audition.
She finessed it.
Exactly. Man, I finessed it like a mofo. Mm-hmm. So that I could go in and basically apply to be a snowboarding instructor. And then they take you out on the hill and then they see your skills and they do a test class with you. And that's how I got hired. So I was able to be a snowboarding instructor. Wow. And get a free, what did I say my favorite four letter word was?
Free.
Free. Free. So, not only did I get a free season pass so that I could go and snowboard anytime, whenever I wanted, but because I was technically a professional, I was getting paid to teach these people, which, I mean, the classes were like 30, it was $30 a class that I got paid for, and it was really just enough for gas and lunch, but...
You get the free pass.
Right. And technically, I'm a professional because I am being paid for it. I do get a paycheck from Mountain High.
Yep.
I could go to Burton, which is like the premier equipment company, and I could say I'm a professional, and then you get a 70% discount.
70%.
Hello. 70 at the time. I don't know what it is now, but at the time, it was a 70% discount on the board and the boots and the bindings, which meant... It was then affordable because it was close to free. So that, you know, I always had a side hustle. I was always hustling
it's
somehow.
Just in our brother.
Always
blood.
Had a hustle. Yeah, if I can't get in through the front door, I'm going to go in through the side. If I can't go in through the side, I'm going to go in through the back.
Okay.
Right. I'm coming,
the basement.
I'm coming through the second floor balcony window. Just leave it cracked because I'm coming. So I was a snowboarding instructor. I worked for Debbie Allen and Norm Nixon. Mm-hmm. I was working as an assistant to Norm Nixon, and he was a sports agent at the time. And then Debbie ended up opening a dance academy.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I worked for Debbie at a dance academy. I mean, I was like doing every single job under the freaking sun. And so I was home one day And meanwhile, I'm writing sort of, I had written a TV spec because I was just so depressed, you know, and my favorite show was X-Files.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to write, hey.
There you go.
And I had to, you know, and I don't know. And it was just a joy for me to write sort of an X-Files episode out of everything that I wanted to see as a fan of the X-Files. But then how am I going to do it and still stay in the realm of what the show does?
Right.
You know, because, you know, they tell you when you write a spec, you know, don't write a spec where the characters are going to have a baby or write a spec where a character dies. Because
you can't
that's
change
not,
it too much.
Exactly,
yeah, right.
Because that's not in the realm of the show week to week. You know, the character's not going to die. The character's not going to have a baby. Right. You have to do something that would actually fit into the parameters of what they do from week to week. So, you know, I had written it just for fun because, you know, I wanted to do a funny, fun episode of The X-Files. And so I sort of had it in my back pocket. And I was like, wow, you know, I wonder if I could become, you know, sort of a... I wonder if I could become a writer on The X-Files. I wonder if I could become a TV writer. But I mean, just nothing was happening. Now I'm 10 years from film school and I didn't know anyone, you know, I had no contacts anymore of how, you know, how to get in.
So all your friends aren't in the business anymore?
My friends were in the business, but they were assistants and they were staff writers. Right. And so they didn't really have, they weren't in the position to where they could sort of, hire me or help me get a gig just yet because they were still getting their feet planted, sort of in the business. So, I'm sitting home one day and I'm flipping channels, depressed as fuck. Mm-hmm. And the show is on TV where it's these regular people are traveling around the world doing these awesome adventure things. And I'm like, what is that show and why am I not on it? So I was like, oh my God, that's The Amazing Race. Uh-huh. So I called my brother.
Show. That was a great show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I called my brother and I'm like, yo, I'm sending you this application. Fill it out. We're going on the show. He's like, wow. All right. So I go home. We make a tape. Mm-hmm. And then I send it in to the Amazing Race people. And we got a call 2 days later to interview. And we made it all the way through. And we were on the third season of The Amazing Race.
That is comedy.
That's why I know you.
Because
I used to watch that show.
Really?
I used to watch that. Like the first couple seasons I watched that. And then I just couldn't get to, you know, whatever time. But maybe that's why you seem familiar to me, because I probably...
Well, I mean, I don't know. We didn't make it too far. We were team... we were team TNT. We were Talisha and Tramell, team TNT. We were explosive.
This sounds too familiar.
TNT, we were explosive, baby.
Where'd you guys go to, like... Did you guys go to, like, to somewhere in the Arab countries? Southeast Asia, where'd you guys go?
No, we went to Mexico. which was funny because in our interview, you know, they were like, so where do you want to go in the world? I was like, send me anywhere. You can send me to South America. You can send me to Antarctica. You can send me to anywhere. Just don't send me to Mexico. And they were like, well, why not Mexico? I'm like, I live in LA. It's like going to Pomona. It's right there. You know? I mean, send me someplace.
Like, I
want to
use my passport.
I want to go around the world. Right. So we started the race in Miami. And then what was our next stop? Mexico. Where were we eliminated? Mexico. I was like, you got to be freaking kidding me.
This is familiar now. This is familiar.
Did y'all miss a train or a bus or something? Oh, man. What happened?
It's a long sorted story as to what... we had some production issues. There was a clue that was missing because, you know, you have to read the clues on camera. Right. There was a clue that was missing and, you know, they brought us the clue. Then we read it on camera. And, I mean, it was just like one thing after another thing start to compound.
Oh, it's going
to
be on YouTube. You know what I'm watching tonight.
Oh, it is.
And
it
we
is.
Were out. Aww. I was like, before we started the race, I was like, Lord... Just please don't let us be eliminated first. We were eliminated second.
Okay.
But wait.
Yeah, exactly.
But was your hustle muscle looking in terms of like looking for a job? Like, I'm on the show.
Well.
Because I know you're a hustler.
Well. So they send you, once you're eliminated, they send you to sort of the elimination city because you know, you can't go back because you can't give up who win the million. If you go back, they know you didn't win the million.
Right.
So we were in Lisbon for about 3.5 weeks until the end of the show, and which they sent us then to Seattle. And then at the party, they have an exit interview with all the teams. I don't know if they still do this, but they did this during our show. So during our exit interview, they were sort of asking us questions. And I was like, what? Why are they asking us these weird questions? Do they think you're going to sue?
Like leading questions?
I mean, like, or? They were asking us questions that, you know, in my opinion, it was like they're trying to figure out whether or not you're so mad that you didn't win the race that you're going to sue. And and maybe they can gain some insight on that. And if you are, then maybe they can get ahead of it. I don't know. But that's what it kind of seemed like. You know, because of the production issues that we kind of had, you know, so it seemed like they were asking us, well, are you going to, you know, and I was like, what, you think we're going to sue? You know, they're like, you're not? I'm like, no, because I never thought that we would win $1 million, but I was just trying to travel the world for free. Because remember, it's my favorite foreign word. I'm broke. I got no money. I want to travel the world, but I got no money. How can I travel the world? What is this show and why am I not on it? I got to get on this show because they're traveling the world for free. I got to do it. You know, so they were like, oh, okay. So, you know, and this is going to piss off all of the actors out there, but, you know, my brother was really funny. I mean, you know, we were the snarking siblings, and he and I would set him up and he would knock him down in terms of the jokes. So, they're casting, they're like, one of the executives was like, you know, Tramiel, we really like to introduce you to our senior executive VP of casting at CBS, you know, and he was like, nah, I'm going back home to Indiana.
Damn.
My friends, when they heard that, they were like, oh my God, I would have killed for that opportunity. He's like, eh, I'm going home to Indiana. Meanwhile, they were like, well, you know, Talisha, is there anything we can help you with? And I was like, actually, yeah, you can read my X-File spec and tell me if it's any good. Right. And if it's not good, just tell me it's not good. Right. And I will go home and I will sell real estate and I will get out of this business. You know, so the executive's like, that's it? I'm like, yeah. So one of the executives, he took on that ask. And he was like, well, you know, we got to wait till the race is over. Right. That airs on TV. We got to wait till it's over. I'm like, okay, now here I am thinking, they're just, you know, they're telling me anything. They're going to wait till the race is over, and then they're just going to forget about me, you know, because then I won't have any recourse. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't true. So, you know, true to his word, you know, the CBS executive, after the race was over, read my X-File spec, and he was like, you know, it's actually pretty good. Okay. And but unfortunately, X-Files has now gone off the air.
Right.
So you're going to have to write something another else. You're going to have to write another one. So I was like, all right. So I got into a class at UCLA Extension. Mm-hmm. I know I'm a traitor to my Trojans, but they don't have extension classes.
They don't have extension classes at USC.
Right. You know? So I took an extension class.
They're missing out on money.
Right. And I know they really are.
It's elitist.
And I wrote a CSI spec, and he read it. He loved it. He passed it on to one of the co-EPs at CSI at the time. That co-EP read it and loved it and had a meeting with me. And they were like, you know, if this is not the best CSI spec I've read, it's certainly within the top three or four.
Wow.
And I was just like, oh my God, I felt gratified because, you know, I picked a point. It was like, you know, if I'm going to do this industry, I've got to do it.
Right.
And I've got to do it and do it to what I know that I need to do. And it was in me to write. But because I knew it was going to be painful, you know, I didn't want to do it. And it's like, you know what? You just got to face it. And so once I faced it and I started doing it, doors started opening like you would not believe. Doors just started opening and opening. You know, that CSI writer, he was like, you know, here's my agent, call them, you know, here's some people to meet, let them tell them I sent you.
What?
And from that time, I started meeting executives.
What I always say, you gotta get an ally.
Thank you.
And and it started happening for me for there. And I was also, at that point in my life, I was also on my year of yes. Just say yes to everything.
Y'all hear that?
And I had a friend who was a motion picture director, and his assistant, a movie director. He directed movies. He directed the cinema, and he was in the cinema. He directed the celluloid that was up on the screen. And his assistant was going to, his assistant was going on vacation. Now, at the time, I was kind of working post. I had developed my own sort of small post company. And so I was making good money. Of course, I didn't want to do no post. Didn't want to ever be in no post. And I was not going to stay in no post. But I didn't need to go be his assistant for 2 weeks. Like, he just answer phones when I got money in the bank. I don't need this. Right. And he's like, but I was on my year. Yes.
Right.
So I was like, yes, I will do it. So I worked for him for 2 weeks. And while I was there, I'm cleaning out his email box. Right. And I'm cleaning out his spam box. And in the spam folder of his email was an email for an agent meet and greet. All right. And I'm reading this. I'm like, and I need an agent. I'm like, it was $75. And I'm like, well, okay, well, if this is a scam, $75 is not a lot to lose
for
the scam. Right. I'm like, all right, so I'm gonna do it. So I did it. And while I'm there, you know, I'm asking these agents questions and I'm cracking jokes and I'm trying to get them to notice me so that I can send them my specs. And then afterwards, the lady who organized this came up to me. She was like, you know, I think you can do comedy. And I'm like, no, lady, I'm drama. I'm doing drama. That's what I want to do is drama. Okay. So then she gave another one of these things. And I went and I did the same thing. I'm cracking jokes. I'm trying to get these agents to notice me so they'll take on my specs. And they'll take me on and they'll read my specs. And at the end, this lady comes up to me and she's like, you know, I really think, you know, you say that you're drama, but I think you can probably do comedy. And, you know, and I have a class and I kind of want you to come take the class.
Is she white or black?
She's white.
Okay.
And I was like, no, lady, I do drama. Okay. But then as I'm walking out, I'm like, okay, ding, 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 ding.
My year of yes.
I was on a comedy show.
My year of yes. Right. And also destiny, free will. I'm making the free will to not choose what she says. And this is probably going to come around like it did the first time. I went to the agent meet and greet. I said, no. Another one came around. I went to it again. I'm saying no. I'm like, you know what? I'm chasing these agents and she's chasing me. Maybe I should turn around and let her catch me. And that became my manager. Her name is Cherie Guitar. She's my manager to this day.
She did the exact same thing to me.
Oh, really?
Exact same thing. We will talk.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She's Kelly's manager.
Yeah, it's Kelly.
Yeah.
Kelly Griffith.
Yeah, Cherie Guitar is my manager. It's now been 15 years that she's my manager.
Wow.
I will never, ever, ever leave Cherie. She, you know, when you're a writer in this business, you know, people, there are managers and then there are agents. And of course, you only want to have one because you don't want to have to pay 10% twice. But you need someone to believe in you. Hopefully, that's an agent.
Right.
But if it's not an agent, you know, get a manager because that one person who believes in you will push and push and push and push for you like nobody's business. And that's what you need in order to get on the top of the pack and be read.
And Cherie's a former writer producer. She knows how to write.
Yeah.
So she can tell you some
good
shit. And
she can tell you. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what she did, even though, you know, over the years I've had agents, you know, but she was always the one that was sort of leading the charge.
Right.
You know, now I'm fortunate to be with a good agency, Verve, where they're also doing the same thing. So it's like now I'm getting, you know, double bang for my buck and covering the town very well, you know, because they work powerful team.
Where my 10%?
Right.
Where my pimp fees at?
Well, I mean, look, you know, like I the thing I say a lot is about agents. Because when I started in this business, like agents actually had some sense of trying to help develop a career and like be able to give constructive notes and stuff like that. But I think in the last 10 years, agents are just closers.
That's certainly what they've been moving towards.
They kind of move to, and that means that you, it hurts because that means that you almost, you're obliged to have a manager and an agent unless you're some top person. But, you know, the right agent will close the deal for you and get the terms you want so that you're really, really fucking happy.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, because that's their job.
Right.
It's kind of like, I was thinking about this now, it's like, they're Alec Baldwin in Glenn Ross. Right. And you know what? And you want that person to go, fuck you, this watch costs more than your car. Like you want that person, you know, like in your corner to get what you need, you know, because you want that at that point, you know. But a lot of times now, particularly because the industry is different now, because it seems that what you're saying, that you got in at a time when people could write specs and get in, you know. Mm-hmm. Now everyone wants you to write your damn original and everything like that. And you kind of need someone who believes in you and to look at your material. And if it's not quite there,
And give you constructive criticism. Feedback,
And they're not going to judge you like, oh, I got to drop this person because I made a mistake.
Exactly. Right. And not a lot. And I don't get me wrong. There are definitely agents out there that do that.
Oh, so I'm saying,
but they are hard to find. Just because the way of the business, you know, in an agent's world, they need to have so many clients in order to stay afloat. So an agent might have something like 60 clients or something like that, whereas a manager might have 20 or 25. But then a manager can also, once that client becomes big enough to then have their own show, that manager could come on as a producer. Correct. And sort of help with producer duties where, you know, is where their pot of gold is. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a little different like that. But anyway, so I was like, okay, it was my year of yes. So I'm like, I'm turning around, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to her class and I'm in the comedy class. And she's like, yeah, I think I could get you into a comedy. I need you to start writing comedy specs. I'm like, God, but I'm not funny. I don't have jokes. But, you know, she was just like, don't worry, just start. I'm going to show you, you know, what to do and, you know, and how to do it. Mm-hmm. And comedy rooms don't work like you think they work, you know. And so it was a whole sort of learning experience on that. It was just like sort of pushing me forward. And so I wrote my comedy specs, and then what do you know? In 2015, I got my first gig, and that was 2 years. I think it was maybe about 2.5 years after she signed me.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately,
which is what the managers do. They will stick with you for a minute.
Yeah.
The agent, if you don't work in a year, they're like, well, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
This isn't working out for us, so we think we should separate ties.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Oh, you don't think so, but we think so. So we're going to separate ties. Thank you and goodbye.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely what they do. The manager or my manager, but some managers, you know, are the same way. But like I said, it is, you have to find that person who believes in you, because there are agents who do that. And, you know, and I'd be remiss to say, to not say that there are.
Right.
But in my experience, you know, the managers do tend to take a little more time with a client and help develop a client if they really believe in them.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Because the manager potentially has more to gain in a sense. He can, you know, he could produce your show. He could produce the movie. I mean, David Alper, you know, is making big money because he's a producer on Walking Dead. But he's the guy, one of the guys who created Circle of Confusion. Right.
I turned them down years ago.
That's just what happens. But you're right. The agent thing is, you know, like, I mean, I think they probably have quarterly meetings, but they definitely have annual meetings where they go over to client list and go, who's made me money? Mm-hmm. Who's talked to me enough this year that they even have projects that potentially make me money? And if you're throwing out projects that don't, you know, they're like, we can't do anything with, or you don't even talk to them or give them updates, whatever it is, let them know that you're trying to do it. They're like, you know what? You get brushed.
Yep.
You get brushed. So let's start to wrap this up, but let me just ask you this question. So, what was that first show you got? What was that?
It was called Thick and Thin, but it never aired, so no one will ever hear anything about it.
Do you have copies of it for your own personal collection?
No, I don't.
Because you've been on a couple of different shows. So
I
just want to throw them out and then get to NCIS real quick.
Sure.
How'd you get from the comedy to not working?
That's what I was about to get into.
Well, okay, so that at that particular time, comedy was basically dying or dead. I mean, dead or dying, you know. So after that gig, I proceeded to do just another whole lot of nothing, because at the time, it was like the rise of reality and the death of comedy. Right. You could not find a show, a comedy on TV to save your life. The only one that was left was like Girlfriends.
Right.
You know, and there was a gig available on Girlfriends, a gig that I didn't get, and I was just like crushed. I mean, because it was really seriously the last comedy in town. Right. So I wanted to work. So at that point, I'm dusting off my
CSI.
Exactly. I'm dusting off my drama specs. And I'm giving the dramas another go. Right. And it just so happened that I knew a showrunner from a friend of mine who that person had worked for. Her name was Nancy Miller. Mm-hmm. And Nancy was Saving Grace. Saving Grace. And Nancy was developing a show, Saving Grace. Mm-hmm. And she was sort of in the pilot stage and she needed an assistant. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been a writer. You know, and usually when you cross that threshold to becoming a writer,
now it's time to let your ego go.
You don't want to go back to being an assistant, right? But I was hungry,
right?
So I was like, sure, because she asked me.
Let me
just
say this: there's also a difference between being an assistant and being an assistant to the showrunner. Who's working on a pilot that is probably going to go.
Right. Well, at the time, it was a big question mark.
Right.
You know, I was hungry.
Right.
And she goes, you know, Talisha, look, I know you want to write. And I know you've been a writer before, but all I really have for you available is an assistant if you want to come and be my assistant. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I was assistant for her for that. For the pilot period during that time, they ended up getting Holly Hunter, which was like, oh my God, Holly Hunter. And then they did the pilot and then, you know, the show came down the pike. And at the time, this was now 2007. Mm-hmm. She didn't know that there was money available for diversity, you know, writers and whatnot, you know, because she ended up hiring her staff. Mm-hmm. And she came to me, she's like, I know you want to be a writer, but we don't have enough money in our budget to bring on another staff writer right now, but I'd really love to keep you in as an assistant. And I was like, well, what if I could become a writer and be free for you? What if I knew a way to become a writer and it wouldn't cost you a dime? Mm-hmm. And she was like, an extra writer on my staff. Tell me more, you know? And I was like, ding, 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 ding. So it was 20th Century Fox. And I knew that 20th Century Fox had just started their program. And my manager knew that, you know, because my manager, you know, she knew the whole game around town, who was offering, you know, positions and who wasn't. So once Nancy connected with 20th Century Fox and found out that she could do that, you know, she ended up bringing me on as, you know, that diversity hire. But now, and a lot of people, you know, they sort of down the diversity hires and it's unfortunate that they do because really, I mean, that's unfortunate because
let me turn this. Is there
no?
He's so caught up in the story.
He's just leaning on it.
I was just saying, it's very interesting.
Look, I'm like my motto is get in where you fit in and worry about it later. You know what I'm saying? So this was definitely a big break for me. And my thing is. You know,
were you there the whole time?
I was not there for the whole time. I was there for the first 2 years. Right. And then there were some complications that happened being the double whammy of the strike and the recession. So once the strike happened and then the recession happened, studios were shrinking budgets. Right. And, you know, and once that happens, what's the first thing you do? You cut off the lower level people because supposedly you don't need them. Now that's very short term thinking because then in 6 or 7 years, those people who were staff writers and story editors, now you need them to be young level co-EPs that can work for a co-EP that can work a co-EP job at a reasonable price, and you don't have them, and you don't have those people there to create your new shows. Yep. And so, I mean, there's been sort of a dearth. You know, of certain positions in Hollywood, you know, and over the last few years because
impact of the strike.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the impact of the strike and the recession.
Here's something that I think is interesting about your situation and the diversity thing and about people being hard on that and things like that. You came in and you worked with Nancy as an assistant. So she knew the value of you during that whole process of preparing the pilot, taking the pilot. Mm-hmm. She recognized everything and you had written and stuff like that. So she wasn't like saying, it's a different situation. And I think that's really interesting because then when you turn around and said to her, you can hire me for free, she didn't see that as like, I gotta get a black writer or a female writer so I don't get fucking shamed. It's like, now I can get someone who I know I can trust to be, and I'll just pay for him, not to pay for him. Right. Because what happens with other people who don't have it that way, who didn't know the showrunner through the pilot situation, and they come on through the diversity thing, everyone doesn't even really know if they can write. Even the showrunner doesn't know if they can write. They're just like, well, I got to take this person. But Nancy obviously was like, well, you can write or not, but I trust you because you helped me get the pilot on the air.
Right.
That's and ultimately when you come in as a young writer, they need to trust you so much because they're like giving you that big opportunity.
Right.
And a lot of times people mess up. And they fail that.
True.
That trust thing.
That's very true.
Yeah.
But I'd like to point out that non-diversity staff writers fuck up too.
Oh, all the time. So all the time.
It's not like,
No.
It's not like, you know, this is a position where people are getting a pass, because it's not.
Right.
You know, it's to help sort of shoehorn in opportunity that should have been there in the first place.
I'm not disagreeing with your point. The point I'm making is that what happens to a lot of diversity writers is they come in that way, and because they fuck up, because it's just, you're young, it doesn't matter if you're black or white or whatever,
right,
you fuck up, the diversity hire, that stamp on you now becomes a major albatross, because I met so many writers who've come in and the diversity writer and they can't get a job the next time, and even if they like performed well and didn't mess up, they still have that stigma as, you came in and we gave you a pass to come in, And the showrunner is not going to have their back necessarily, which I think is very disappointing about those, you know, like those diversity programs.
True, but you know, that is all that's also dependent upon who the showrunner is.
Yeah. True,
because I'm going to give, you know, Nancy Millett all the credit in the world.
She's dope.
She, you know, her first show, or not her first show, but one of her shows, you know, Any Day Now, you know, of course, was about sort of a black girl and a white girl who grew up together.
My mother loved that show.
Yeah, my mother loved it too. who grew up together, you know, in Mississippi, and, you know, in sort of their present day, the past day and present day sort of situations. And she hired, her staff was probably the most diverse in television at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when she did that, I mean, she's even said in other interviews, you know,
I've read interviews where she says showrunners should be hiring more diverse.
Yeah. And she was like, you know, when I did that, oh my God, why not do that?
Right.
Because they're bringing in stories that I've never heard before, and it makes my show better.
Right.
She said, from that point on, every show that she's had, she has to have a diverse room and a diverse production team, because it makes her show better. Mm-hmm. And that is true. So if you're one of those showrunners who truly believes in the value of having a diverse staff, never mind the diversity writer.
Right.
I mean, having a diverse staff, you know, having women, having, you know, Latinos, having Asians, having, you know, black people, having gay people, you know, if you truly believe in the value of a diverse staff, then, you know, you can get a diversity writer that will mess up and it won't be any big deal, because it was just, you realize it's just that person.
Right.
I can get another one and give another one a chance, you know. But then not only that, but your entire staff is going to be diverse. So I was diversity hire on Saving Grace, but I certainly wasn't the only woman on that staff.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wasn't the only black person on that staff. You know, I just happened to be the person who was given a leg in the door.
Right.
Because this person believes in the value of all stories at the table.
Right.
You know,
and yeah, well, I mean, and that's, I think, the big difference, because there's a lot of shows that you hear about a lot where they don't necessarily believe in the diversity thing.
True. They're just getting their free rider.
And they get the free rider, and then they're...
And then they abuse it. And they abuse it. And the problem with that is...
next year, I'm going to get someone new.
And then unfortunately, that's what ends up happening to those young... A lot of times, that's what ends up happening to those young writers, because those showrunners are kind of abusing that position, because they'll get their free staff writer for 20 weeks, and then they'll kick them to the curb and get another staff writer for 20 weeks because it's free, right. You know, whereas, and the programs have changed over the years, where the programs will actually pay more now, will pay a year or 2 years. But in the beginning, back during those days, when you have a writer for 20 weeks, which is the first half of a season, mm-hmm. which is the first 13 and then the back nine, there's a lot of talk in Hollywood that happens that doesn't happen face to face. Meaning the talk in Hollywood, how you get labeled and why no one will hire you, is if you were in a diversity program on a show with a jerk showrunner who didn't want to hire you for the back nine due to nothing you did and let you go after 20 weeks, the stigma you then have is that you did something wrong and you're not a good writer.
That's the whole point I'm bringing up.
So that's the stigma that you have, because then when the next time when someone looks at your resume, they were like, oh, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. That was a show that lasted 23 episodes and yet you were only on for 13. I know what that says. Right.
And you were the diversity hire?
You're the diversity hire? Yeah, exactly.
Because they're assuming, number one, they always tell us as a staff writer, they're like, you know, you should be the first one there and the last one to leave. If somebody doesn't want to do research with them, you should be the one doing it. Mm-hmm. You need to find that little superpower in the room where you can do whatever, yada, yada, yada.
Absolutely.
So that's saying, even if you did all that shit, doesn't make a fucking difference.
Exactly.
You know what
I mean? Exactly. Because a lot of times, too, you know, showrunners, when they're hiring, I mean, it is fast and furious.
Right.
You know, the showrunners, you know, depending on where, what agency package the show, you know, the agency might be throwing writers your way, mm-hmm. you know, which can come with the package. You know, I'm not quite certain of all the details in a package. But, you know, so if you're coming from a different agency, it's going to be hard to get on that showrunner's desk. Right. So, you know, for a showrunner to then look at your script and then do all this due diligence on you and actually call the last showrunner and say, hey, how was this person mm-hmm. to work for?
It's work.
It's work. Mm-hmm. It's work that they don't want to have to do because, you know, they are human beings mm-hmm. and they want to go home to their families and see their kids.
Right.
So if they're looking at your resume and your resume tells a story, they're like, are on to the next one.
That's the narrative that gets believed. And there's no reason to dig deeper in because you said no time.
Right. Exactly.
And it's sad.
And that's when you need the super manager. That's when you need the superhero with the cape on their back. That's when you need
knocking down doors.
Exactly.
Gonna
the superhero manager who can then say, you know, who will take the assistant out for lunch, for free lunch. And if you're an assistant and you're working, you know, for a showrunner, anybody, mm-hmm. and somebody offers you a free lunch, you're taking it.
You're going. Right.
All right. And then that super manager says, hey, can you put my person to the top of the pile? By the way, I know that their resume says 13 weeks on a 40-week show or mm-hmm. 20 weeks on a 40-week show, 13 episodes on a 22-episode show. But here's the story behind that. So then when the assistant goes back and puts your script on top of the pile and the resume on top of the pile and the showrunner's looking at it and they say, oh, they were only 20 weeks on it. They can say, oh, well, you know, it was because it's so-and-so's room and so-and-so changed.
They know.
They talk.
Change writers.
Right.
Oh, yeah. They absolutely know and they absolutely talk. But, you know, but to have a manager or an agent who is your advocate, who can go clean up the messes, you know, sort of your messes, you know, because I kind of made a mess one time. it was over the Warner Brothers program. I did. I made a mess. Ooh, look at that mess. the Warner Brothers program, I had written, you know, my CSI and whatnot and applied to the Warner Brothers program and I became a semifinalist or a finalist or something like that, but I didn't get it.
Right.
Okay. And the person who was over the program at the time was like, you know, call me and we can set up a time to talk and I can tell you what the things to improve, you know, on your script. mm-hmm. and, you know, in your presentation so that you'll do better. So I was like, oh, great. So I called her and I left a message and it was a week. Nothing happened. So I called her again, left a message. It was 3 days and mm-hmm. nothing happened. So I called again, left a message. It was another week. Nothing happened.
Are y'all hearing this?
And so then I called again like a week later and she picks up the phone and she says, don't call me ever again. Click.
Wow.
It's like, but, oh,
but you said.
What did I do? What did I do? I was just trying to do the right thing.
Right.
So, yes, I was lucky enough to have my manager. I mean, after that happened, my manager, who was then talking to the Warner Brothers program about me, they were like, oh, that girl? She did this. She called me a million times. And I had to tell them not call.
Well, there's an eight-day rule. You got to do the eight-day rule.
What's the eight-day rule?
You call people and you got to wait 8 days before you call them back.
Oh, yeah, I see. I didn't hear that rule. I had never heard that rule.
Every, you know.
And so my manager goes, she goes, talks to the person. She's like, oh, yeah, you know. Talisha, she's a young writer. She didn't know. But that's why I'm here now. Right. So I can do the dance. La, 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 la. How about I take you out to lunch? La, 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 la. Now we clean up that mess. Right. Now, why don't you think about her
exactly
for the shows?
Exactly right. Right. Exactly right.
So NCIS. So,
yeah, we got to get
New around. Orleans.
Really, really quick.
Yes. Okay. So After Saving Grace was NYC 22. Mm-hmm. And that was a show that was about rookies in Harlem with right.
It was
a CBS show and the head writer was Richard. Oh my God, please cut this out. Okay. That I'm blanking on his name.
I just want to know what the show was. So
About rookies in New York City. Right. It was great because they sent me to New York to live there so I could be in the room. Then after NYC 22 was Ironside. Mm-hmm. And after Ironside was
with Blair Underwood?
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
With Blair Underwood?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yep. The new Ironside with Blair Underwood, who is a wonderful, fantastic mm-hmm. human being. Mm-hmm. And then after that was Switched at Birth. Mm-hmm. And then after that was The Originals. And then after The Originals is NCIS.
Is that Richard
New
Price?
Orleans. Richard Price, mm-hmm. yes. So, yes, NYC 22 with the esteemed,
yeah.
writer yes. Richard Price, right. which was yeah. wonderful to learn under his tutelage.
That's what's up. So, shout out to Paul Gio. Our
Paul Gio of Gio Storm.
Isn't that coincidence?
I know. That's a great coincidence.
That's hilarious. So how you having fun on the show? You love
it? Oh my God,
show?
It's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I'm working on an incredible staff mm-hmm. and I'm working with two incredible showrunners, Brad Kern and Chris Silber, mm-hmm. who are wonderful, fantastic. I mean, I can't say enough about them. And they are two people who also believe in, you know, bringing young writers up, you know, sort of through the ranks, right. You know, bringing up the assistants to right. become yeah. sort of staff writers, you know, and giving out scripts to the script coordinator and
wow,
the
to the
writers
script coordinator.
Oh yeah. The script coordinator, the wow. writer's assistant.
What's that story about the Blade Runner whiskey that I was just
oh, that shall stay in my mind. Yeah, so and they've been, you know, sort of really great and really supportive in the new writers on the staff sort of learning.
Is this your first
show.
Year too?
This is my first year okay. on this series. And I'm having a ball, I'm having a blast. And you know, and the best part about being a producer on a series like this is you get to go produce your episode yes.
in New Orleans.
Now this comes back to all that post
Woo-hoo.
You did.
Yes.
Oh yes.
You don't have to learn all that shit.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's a little different from what I was doing. I was just doing tags, which, you know, involved
tag
tonight
team.
At back 7 p.m. Friends. You know, that's all I did was tags yeah. pretty much. But it's been incredible because, you know, you go down to the set, the production team is wonderful, very mm-hmm. welcoming. The cast is, you know, is really great. Right. They're all just like top notch people.
They get to write for the GOAT.
Yeah, okay. Oh yeah. You
I
know.
See her.
CCH.
Oh my yes. gosh. Yes.
Madam Pounder.
Yes. And she, man, Queen. She makes you feel like a celebrity when you get down there because she'd be like, she'll come over to you, be like, hey honey, you mind if I get a selfie with you? I'm like, with me? You want to get a selfie with me? Ah! Oh my God, yes. So yes. It was a lot of fun. I mean, and I'm sorry, but yeah, New Orleans with a city of less than 400,000 people.
You, gives Lisa, a tell her really quickly your little story.
About that. Look,
they was down there doing a girl's trip.
I did hear a little bit of that on Geo Storm's episode.
That's right.
It was fun. And like I said, I was at the hotel, looked outside. I'm like, oh, the Scat Bakula. Oh, they did. Paul, y'all cheap. Where you at?
Yep.
But it was awesome, though, because it's like they had the people there. And the thing about New Orleans is, I don't know, New Orleans, they've been through so much. Like, it's having a TV show just being produced. Right. People mind their business. They go buy their
drink. They're putting the money back in the damn city.
400,000 people?
Right. Something like that.
How many?
That small of a city? Maybe 500,000 people.
Listen, I was ducking and diving from relatives. Like, I was going around with a hand grenade and ducking down in my lift, like, don't go down this street. I did see one of my cousins, like, oh, shit.
It's definitely a small town, but you know what? It stays turnt. Stays turnt.
For no reason.
For no reason.
For no reason.
For no reason.
That's the reason why it does.
Two weeks before Halloween, they have it. I mean, their second favorite holiday besides Mardi Gras is Halloween.
Right.
And you will go down there during the Halloween time. Everybody's got decorations on the door. I'm like, it's like, you know, it's like naughty Christmas.
Naughty,
you know.
Christmas.
I mean, they're there. It's crazy, and they stay turned up. I mean, they give New York a run for their money when they say, you know, the city that never sleeps. I don't know. I mean, for a city as small as New Orleans. I'm like, I think the title should belong to them.
I got three words. You already know. That's
it. Hey, that's why they call it the beginning of the Caribbean. Exactly. You know, it's one of those places. Because it does, I mean, if you've never been to New Orleans, it does, especially politics and stuff, it reminds me a lot of, like, if you want to start your trip in the Caribbean, you're going to start New Orleans and then work your way down to wherever you're going. It's one of my favorite cities.
I love it.
It's an old city. Ancient is awesome.
Well, thank y'all. Awesome. Thank you, Talicia.
Well,
we appreciate
having
you. Lisa, Chris y'all know stories. How we do it on the Rant Room. Shit. So where you at, Lisa? Lisa Colt Jam?
Well, you all know I'm always on Twitter. I'm a Twitter fiend. You'll find me in the hashtag Saturday Night Sci-Fi or whenever Graveyard Shift Sister has her Friday Night Horror. Bitch Flicks, write film critical, you know, film reviews for them. I'm trying to think. There's something else. Oh! Has nothing to do with TV or film, but I just want to shout this out. Hey, y'all, Thanksgiving is coming up. BevMo is going to be open.
She fixed herself.
So when y'all going to listen, when you are binging on your shows, get those sales on your drink for your Netflix, for your Hulu. I'm just trying to be a public service announcement. BevMo, hook me up. I'm just saying, get ready to watch some great shows. And also, I'm looking forward to seeing DeWanda.
Yes. Oh, she might
she's
be back
She's got to have
week.
It.
She might come back on the
so
show.
So y'all make sure y'all watch. It's coming out Thanksgiving, so she's got to have it. Support DeWanda Wise. That's my girl.
Yeah.
Got to see The Climb. You didn't see The Climb.
Oh,
you got to
see
The Climb.
Yes.
It's on. Hey, yeah, let's shout that out right now. Everybody, go to Amazon. Check out The Climb. That's our girl, D'Ara Kilpatrick's new show.
Yes.
She wrote it. She created it. She stars in it.
I saw
she
the pictures.
Producer.
I saw some pictures.
Go, bitch. Mm-hmm. Go.
Yes.
What are you at, Chris?
Very good. So I am on Twitter and Instagram, primarily on Instagram because I'm told I'm not on Twitter enough by certain
Neither
individuals.
Neither am I. Don't worry about it.
But I'm also, like I said before, there's the new theme set up for SatterboxerCinema.net. On Twitter, I am at UnauthorizedCBD. Same with an Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I am.
Cool. Where you be?
Where you at, Talicia?
Mm-hmm. Sister girl. I don't use Instagram like everybody else does, but I am on it. You know, you will find like maybe three pictures in my Instagram account. But I'm on Twitter probably a little more.
Okay.
And that's at Raggedy with two R's and two G's. So RRAGGEDY. Raggedy, both Twitter and Instagram.
That's a Spanish R. Raggedy.
Raggedy. Raggedy. Yeah.
So thank y'all for joining us. We appreciate it. Y'all see some of y'all. We got y'all out there.
Oh, yeah. I forgot they're taping.
Again.
Hey, watch.
This is our first time we're just trying to go live and see how it works.
Right.
If the shit works, we might do it every once in a while.
You know,
we ain't
going to
do it every
me and Chris sitting here trying our best. Yeah. Like,
don't get used to it, y'all. We ain't going to do it every week.
No, thank God. Thank God.
I didn't shave and shit. I mean, come on.
You know what? I know. I didn't wear earrings.
I
didn't put my earrings.
I would have had my Universal FanCon t-shirt on, but you know, it's all right.
I would have worn my Superman t-shirt.
You ain't wear no ascot. Come on now.
So y'all know how we do it on the Rant Room. I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me on Twitter. You guys can follow the show, screenwritersrantroom@gmail.com. Did I say Twitter? I did. And then email, yada, yada, yada. I can't even think straight. Let's see what else is going on. A lot of good shit. Back again, writing again. Shit is good. Got a couple new projects about to work on, so that's good. Got the kids in here. We got some shit going on. I see y'all bitches. join in with me, everybody. Oh, go on iTunes. Give us a 5-star review. We need that for the metrics. Please follow us on Facebook. For those of you guys who are watching right now, we do have a Facebook page.
Get your clothes ready for Black Panther.
Yes.
Your church clothes.
She said everybody going to be dressed
up. Get your hair appointments. Get your nails and toes
Get your shit lined up.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Look.
So everybody join in with us for Wakanda. We know how it goes. So on this show, we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what, everybody?
Wakanda. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Peace, y'all.
Ciao.
Peace. I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Rant Room. You wanna be a writer, well you gotta be a writer till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the rant room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Rant Room.